Funding for the Think Podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu.
When Qian Juli Wang was 7 years old, her life shifted as radically as if she'd entered a new dimension. It wasn't just that her mother had picked her up and moved her from China to the U.S. to join Wang's father, who had gone after spending his own childhood watching his family beaten and humiliated for being on the wrong side of the Cultural Revolution. In addition to having to learn a new language and a new culture, Wang also had to cope with hunger for the first time, as her college professor parents could only get unskilled jobs at first. She had to watch out for police in a new way for fear of being deported. She went from being the most popular kid in her class to being bullied and underestimated by both students and teachers. And strangest of all, she had to try and make sense of the way so much upheaval had changed her parents. Her playful father was suddenly angry and on edge. Her brilliant, confident mother turned to her daughter as her only confidant, sharing worries and asking for advice far beyond the scope of any child. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It was all so very different than what the Wang family might have expected from their move to the United States, and it's a story that offers insight into just how challenging it can be to start over, even in a place that promises to be better than where you came from. Qian Juli Wang is managing partner of the civil rights and education law firm Gottlieb & Wang LLP and author of the memoir Beautiful Country. Qian Juli, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris. I'm so glad to be here.
You write that your story really starts decades before you were ever born. How much did you know as you were growing up about the trauma your father had experienced as a child?
I knew very little. He did not enjoy talking about it. I only knew that whenever the topic of the Chinese government or the Cultural Revolution came up, he would bang on tables and get very upset. It wasn't until I was an adult that I was able to get him to be a little bit more open about his past.
Your mother's family was actually tied to the government. Her father had some power, but it didn't protect her from the kind of, I guess, rampant sexism that would limit her prospects as a brilliant young person who happened to be female. What sort of career did she have for herself in China?
She was an incredibly successful math professor, and she was on the cutting edge of developing computer science, which back then in the late 80s, early 90s was a really new area. One of my earliest memories of my mother is sitting in front of the supercomputer that took up the entire room and typing commands into a black screen. And this was before most people ever saw computers, knew what they were. She was just remarkable in her field and of course, as a human being.
It must have been hard for her to leave that. Do you know anything about the conversations your parents had in which your father convinced her to leave China?
I know only a little bit. And as I say often in my memoir, I was a pretty sneaky kid, so I often eavesdropped. And I remember hearing phone calls where we would, you know, go into offices where we can make these long distance calls because they were not easy to make back then in China. And her saying, "When are you coming back? You told me you'd come back this month. Why are you not coming back?" And him saying that it was safer over there and that they could stand to make more money. And this went on for, I mean, pretty much from when I was 5 to 7. And finally, she relented and gave up everything. And it should be noted that she never left her hometown as an adult. She stayed very close to her parents. They lived a few blocks from us. All I knew was being surrounded by my maternal grandparents and my maternal uncles. So it was a huge decision, not just for her, but for me and how she chose to raise me.
So your dad was also a university professor in China. He taught English literature. How did the regime try to control what he could talk about with his students?
He really could not talk about Chinese history. That's why he sought out English literature, because Dickens criticized the British society. He could use that as a lens, as a means of teaching social critique. But Cultural Revolution books or the topic at all were pretty much completely banned back then. And I believe still is to this day. And he got incredibly frustrated because he saw so much of English culture and American culture reflected through Mark Twain and Dickens, and how open, relatively speaking, they were able to be about the world they saw and the problems that they noticed afflicted it. And he dreamed of being in a place where he could speak and write and teach openly about that.
Did he imagine before he left China that his English proficiency would make it easy for him to start over?
Yes. Well, I think he wasn't sure how he would fare in a country where everyone was a native English speaker. He was the best English speaker in China, in North China, in our town. But I think he still wasn't entirely sure, because also back then in China, there was very little information about what it was actually like in the U.S. and especially in New York City. We had really opposing depictions, one of poverty and hunger and homeless people lining the street, and another of wealth and streets paved with gold. And it was unclear to us, even, you know, for my father, who understood that censorship was very much at large in China, we didn't know which end of the spectrum it was. So it was a real dice roll for him to board that plane and leave and not know when he might be able to come back.
So when you write about your childhood before your family left for the U.S., it seems your memories are all wrapped up in a kind of confidence, right? That you fit in, that you matter, that you were surrounded by people who loved you. At seven, did it occur to you as you were leaving that any of that might change?
I did not think that far. I mean, I think that's kind of the beauty of children. We just focus on what was in front of me. What I was really mad about was giving up my new bike that my uncle had just bought me, and giving up my toys. I got to bring one doll, and not seeing my friends, because I was, you know, kind of the leader and kind of bossy, and I liked to boss my friends around, and I was preoccupied, and I don't think it sank in that I might not come back. To my mind, I think at the time I was like, oh, we're just going to go see my father, and then all three of us will come back, and then I can ride my bike, and hopefully it'll still be there. So yeah, it's looking back that kind of protected me, but also, you know, I was not nearly prepared enough for what was to come.
Literally, though, on the plane to the U.S., your role and your mother's started to reverse. She was scared and airsick, and you found yourself sort of looking after her.
Absolutely. And my mother had always struggled with motion sickness. I remember this from even before we left China. When we would go on buses or in taxis, she would get sick almost right away. But almost always there was an adult there, my grandmother, my aunt, my uncle helping. It was never my responsibility. So while I was vaguely aware of my mom's discomfort, it did not overpower my world in the way that it started to on the plane and for the many years thereafter.
What sort of place did your family live in when you were first reunited?
We lived in kind of a tenement style home, kind of on the border of Park Slope and Flatbush in Brooklyn. We were in one room. It was a house, but each room was divided into kind of its own apartment. It was rented to a new immigrant. Everyone in the house shared the kitchen, which was infested with cockroaches. Well, the whole house was infested with cockroaches, and the bathroom. And my delight and joy of that house was the backyard, because it was not a well-kept yard, but there were a lot of stray cats. And those cats, among books, became my very first friends in America.
It was there in this building that you experienced racism for the first time. And you felt like you were no longer just a normal kid and everything you did was somehow wrong. Everybody there, as you've described it, was an immigrant. What made you so different among those other immigrants?
There were no Asian or Chinese immigrants in that neighborhood. It was mostly Latino-based immigrants. So I remember the first time I went into the shared kitchen, there was a boy, a teenage boy, who lived in one of the other rooms with his family. And he saw me and just pulled his eyes back into a squint and made a face at me. And then every time from there on out, when he saw me, he would make that face. And I had no idea, of course, what that face was, because I had not been conditioned to think, oh, Asians have small eyes and that's how we look to other people. And so it was incredibly perplexing for a very long time. I mean, just the concept of different eye colors, as I mentioned, my observations in the airport was something brand new to me. I had only been around people who looked like me, where I just completely fit in.
What kind of companionship did you find watching TV?
This also happened in the backyard. There was a little shrine where our landlady kind of showed respect to her ancestors. And there was a little TV on the shrine. And the very first TV show I watched in New York was The Simpsons. And I remember seeing the cartoons and how they were all so yellow and weird looking with bulbous eyes and thinking, this is the strangest like depiction of human beings ever. And then, of course, again, I saw a depiction of an Asian character on the show, and he had smaller eyes. He also had lighter skin, which didn't make that much sense to me. And I looked at it, I was like, oh, this is how people see us. There's something wrong with how I look, because our eyes are not bulbous like the other characters, which were normalized. And yeah, that was my discovery of television. I watched The Simpsons kind of habitually after that every night. My parents found a little TV in the trash on the sidewalk, and we brought it home. And it was in part through the TV and through books that I learned English.
So you didn't tell your parents when you were hungry. You didn't tell them that you had trouble seeing and probably needed to see an eye doctor. And you write that as you got older, you became kind of a habitual liar. Do you see a relationship between those two things?
Oh, absolutely. I think the whole idea of secrets is that it makes you feel like you have to lie because you feel like you have something to be ashamed about. And so I felt like I had something to be ashamed about with regards to the outside world in terms of my undocumented status. But I also felt like I had something to be ashamed about with regard to myself. Like, why can't I take care of myself? Why can't I feel full? Why can't I just see the chalkboard? It's my fault that I have these problems, and I really should not burden my parents with them. And the shame of secrets, the shame of lies is something that I think all children learn quite early on, or can learn very early on. And it's almost a subconscious thing where then once it seeps into your thinking, it starts to affect you in every facet. And that's what I was noticing happening as I got older. It was like, well, I do not feel proud of who I am or where I'm from or what my family is. So why not make up some sort of, you know, fanciful lie?
Your dad, meanwhile, the move was his idea, but he got to the U.S. and suffered from this kind of crushing sense that he'd been seen as a full man living in Zhongguo, where you were from, but was viewed in the United States as being somehow small and fragile. How did the weight of that start to change the way he behaved at home?
He really started asserting, you know, the sense of masculinity that I, at least, and my mother never noticed in China. He would say things like, I'm the man of the house, you know, it's my decision, we're going to stay in America for the rest of our lives, no matter how hard it is. There were just things that he would do that really showed, I mean, in hindsight, I see it, right? He felt emasculated by the outside world and by American society. And in turn, he felt like he had to domineer the two women in his household. And then my mom started talking about, you know, I don't know what's going on. Is he cheating on me? What's going on? He just feels like a different person. And I can totally see how living in American society with those stereotypes, under the weight of those stereotypes for all three of us, changed us all profoundly in how we treated each other.
So you went to school with a lot of other Chinese kids, but language was still a barrier because, as you mentioned, they mostly spoke Cantonese and English, and you at the time spoke Mandarin when you first got there. Were you basically on your own to learn English?
Pretty much. There was a girl in my class who happened to speak Mandarin as well as Cantonese, and the teacher assigned her to translate for me. But understandably, I think for any 7-year-old kid, you don't want to be responsible for a new child in your classroom. And I don't know, looking back, how she possibly could have translated everything the teacher was saying while learning herself. So there was a lot of friction with that. I think she really resented me for being put in that position, understandably so. And yeah, after a day, she complained and the teacher put me in a special needs classroom where the teacher was incredibly overwhelmed with children who had much bigger needs than I did. And I was kind of left to myself, and I just started reading and pressing, you know, buttons on books that had the 3D display and learning how to speak English through those books.
You share this heartbreaking story of Christmas. I don't know if it was your first Christmas in the U.S., but you were really excited about the class gift exchange, but you also kind of had to handle the whole thing yourself. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, it was my first Christmas. I remember because I had no idea what Christmas was. And our teacher said Christmas is a time of giving. And so we celebrate that by engaging in a Secret Santa gift swap. And of course, I didn't know what Santa was, but I understood that I was to draw a name from something that was passed along of a classmate and then buy a gift. And I believe, was it $10 or $20 was the maximum, which seemed like a crazy amount of money to me that I could not fathom. But I did have some money that my parents let me keep from the sweatshop. So I went to the stationery store that where I often went after school and longed for Hello Kitty pencils. I would often play and touch the pencils, but of course could not afford them. And I bought the pencil that I longed for weeks and did not think to wrap it because I didn't understand that that was the custom. I also played and with the pencil and used it that night before I had to bring it to class. So it was a little bit used up. So I just put it in a little brown bag and submitted it to the gift exchange. And as the class went through opening their gifts, which were all priced appropriately, they were all much more expensive than that pencil that I maybe spent $1 or $2 on. I just felt myself sinking into my seat. I was so mortified. And it just so happened that the girl's name that I pulled was the richest, wealthiest girl in class. She had talked about going to Disney World a few days before that, and I was very envious of her. And she opened the miserable little brown bag and took out this Hello Kitty pencil, which looked so small from the front of the classroom. And I was just so embarrassed. And I had written Merry Christmas, Love, Chien, because I thought everyone wrote love. So as she read it out, people also started laughing because I guess in second grade, when you say love, it's inappropriate. And I got a great gift. I got a teddy bear. It was a teddy bear that I treasured. And I just felt like so exposed for being poor and a fraud and not knowing what I was doing and so guilty for not getting her an appropriate gift. Yeah, I carry the shame of that with me for, I would say, many, many years.
I mean, it sounds like when you think about it, even now, you know that you shouldn't feel bad about something like that, which was entirely beyond your control. But it sounds like it's still hard to think about.
Yeah, just to have that kind of class divide exposed and just the pure ignorance of my frame of context just showed how out of touch I was and how very different I was from everyone else. And I think anyone who's been a child can relate to that feeling, just being the other and being so prominently the other is, something that I can still feel deep down. I like to say that I have healed from it and moved on and learned from it. But, you know, there's still that little girl inside me who feels deeply humiliated about that experience.
There were some joys in your life, even during that time. Will you tell us about Chatham Square?
Absolutely. Chatham Square is a public library branch in New York City's Chinatown. I didn't know it was even there. It was pretty much a block away from my school, but I didn't know it existed until our teacher took us to a library school trip, and a librarian read us The Very Hungry Caterpillar and Clifford and some of the other books. And then we were to go back to school. So I followed very miserably my class back to school. But I knew immediately as soon as I got out, I was going to run back to that library. And I did. I ran to the children's section. I just lived and breathed those books. I discovered the Babysitter's Club, which I was obsessed with. I felt so at home. I started organizing books and moving them around based on how I thought they should be organized, which to this day, I think it should be color-coded. I know that's controversial. But I got in trouble for that. And yeah, it was, I would say, my first home, a place where I felt safe. Like, I felt like I belonged, even though the librarian told me to stop messing the books up. They were very kind to me. They recommended books to me. I was a known figure. And it was that kind of feeling of extended family that I so missed.
So your mom had an acquaintance, I don't know that you could call him a friend, this client from a job that she got at a salon. And it seems to have been a really confusing relationship for you. Like, he had the power to buy you things, to take you to McDonald's. He also had a certain amount of, like, power over your family.
Absolutely. I think it was really shaped my view of men, older men, white men from the get-go. This man very clearly had a bit of an Asian fetish. He loved trawling Chinatown for women that he would then invite to take to McDonald's. He would invite to take their whole families, as he did with my mom. But it was very clear from the way he looked at women. And somehow I could pick up on it in my body, even though I didn't consciously know. It just felt sexual. It felt sexualized. And that made me feel very gross and dirty in a way. But he was also the one who took us to McDonald's. He started taking us to McDonald's every Saturday. My dad would come along and I got my first Happy Meal because of him. He eventually gave me my first cat, who I had for a little while. So yeah, it felt very transactional. Like, he was just extremely lonely, maybe. And looking back, a very sad man, and we had something to offer him, and in turn we needed what he had. But yeah, it was the very first form of transactional relationship that I was exposed to, and probably colors my view of, you know, these kind of trade-offs for relationships to this day.
I wonder, as you got older, if you judged your mother for being okay with that relationship.
I don't think I ever did. I mean, I think I intuitively understood that she wanted to give me some semblance of a regular American childhood, whatever that may be. And even from what we knew in China, McDonald's was a big part of that. Like, we understood that American kids went to McDonald's and got Happy Meals and played in the ball pen. That was like a picture in our head. And so, looking back, if anything, I understand all the more why she felt like she had to do that, and why maybe she had hoped that I wouldn't notice that anything was amiss.
So your mother had started taking computer science classes, I guess, at night in hopes of getting a better job. And this is so poignant to me because I think about her having been the professor in China, and then she is, you know, taking these U.S. classes. She probably could have taught the section that she took. She did graduate, but she was still really having a hard time finding a job, right?
Yeah, I mean, everywhere she I believe she tried a few interviews, but at any place you get past the first stage, they start asking for documents, and at which point she just had to disappear, because what was she going to say? We just didn't have any. So she realized that the act of getting a legitimized American degree was not enough. She also had to have the papers. And she also had a language barrier. She was, as I mentioned, a math professor in China, so her English was not great. She started learning it when I did, but she was 30, and it takes you a lot longer to pick up. And she just felt, after, you know, getting her master's and trying to go out there and failing, I think that was the point at which she felt really hopeless. Like, she said, I've done everything I could have thought to do. We are still in the very same situation. And it was heartbreaking for me to see that and just see her cry every day and say, we have to leave, but I don't know how.
And this is when the illness that she had started getting worse and worse. She was hospitalized, and it was so bad that you had like a superstition with yourself. Like, if you saw this patient in the next room, you knew your mother would still be there and alive.
Yes. I mean, I think in those scenarios, you kind of need some sort of faith to hold on to because you're so out of control. And I felt so incredibly out of control. So I said, you know, if I saw this other old lady in the hospital room next to her, then she would be fine. Or if I crossed the street before the light started changing, then she would be safe. And I would do these little things where I had some control. I could run to cross the street. I could make sure to look in the door to see the little old lady before I got to my mom. Those were very tiny ways in which I could exact some form of power over our lives.
You missed out on some things that you could have done as an American kid because you felt responsible for your mom, not just sort of for her physical well-being, but for her emotional well-being. Can you talk about the things you were reluctant to do for fear of leaving her without you?
Oh, God, there was so much. I mean, I even felt guilty staying home instead of going to work with her. She had some really, really arduous jobs. She worked at a sushi processing plant where she stood in ice water for 12, 14 hours at a time. And I would go with her on Saturday, but I didn't go with her after school. And she said, no, you don't, that's no environment for a kid. You should just go straight home. And I did, but I happily did my homework in front of the TV. But every day that passed, I just felt so incredibly guilty for not being there for her and leaving her to bear that freezing cold environment alone. And there were many, many situations like that where I would just kind of deny myself the opportunity. For instance, graduation week for elementary school was a week full of field trips. It was a celebration, but my mother was sick and in the hospital. And I said, I'm not, you know, I simply cannot enjoy myself. I'm just going to go to the hospital and I will skip out because I do not deserve to have that fun while my mother was in pain.
How did you learn that she had made the decision finally to take you and leave the United States?
It was very drastic. I came out of my then middle school and she was in a car that my dad had bought without speaking to her, that she was very upset about. And I said, what are you doing? I didn't even notice her at first because I was reading, and she honked the horn. She was like, I thought I missed you. And I went over and then I saw that in the back seat was all of our stuff, suitcases. And I got in and she said, we're going to Canada. And I said, what? She was like, I found a way out. We're going to go now. And I was like, what? And my mother and my father had just had a fight. So I was too scared to bring him up at all, but it clicked within me silently. Oh, we're leaving my father behind. Now with this move to yet another country, I've lost one more family member. And it was terrifying for me because she seemed confident that Canada would be better. But the last time I switched countries, it didn't turn out so well. But she had hope, and that was enough to kind of support her and keep going. And we got ourselves to Canada with the help of a friend.
It's a really interesting shift in the book because it seems like for the first time in years, she sort of knew what she wanted and she was telling you what was going to happen instead of asking you what should happen.
Absolutely. And I figured out slowly that she had been working on this for months, probably for the better part of a year, to get the, you know, permission to move to Canada is a big endeavor. And we showed up at the border and she knew exactly what papers to present. And I kept thinking like, oh, do you need my help? Do you need my help? And she said, go sit over there and wait. And yeah, it felt like, oh, I'm reverting back to that state that I was in China, except that's not possible because these intervening years have made it impossible for me to kind of let go of that worry and concern and fear at all times.
So the point of Canada was that immigration would be possible for you despite having been in the U.S. as undocumented folks for years?
Yes, and there was universal health care, which was crucial for us because my mother, even though she was released from the hospital, got sick again and got readmitted, and we didn't know how long she would be sick. And for her, she said, you know, I am very well educated. I have the power to do a lot of good work, but I simply can't. And at least this way, I can work. I can do real work and make a real living. And she was convinced that that would be our salvation. And she was right.
One thing I'll have to confess is that I wasn't expecting your dad to rejoin the family. I sort of thought the end of the story would be you and your mom went to Canada and your dad fended for himself.
I thought that too. I was shocked to see him in China. But after all these years, you know, they're still together. And I have to confess, there were times that I really didn't think they belonged together. There were instances where I prayed that they would get divorced. But now seeing them and how much they've grown together, I mean, they've shown tremendous growth even in the past 10 years. And upon publication of this book, I see that they are a good match. I have to admit it.
So what was the adjustment like for you to go from Brooklyn to Canada? I mean, was it an easier shift than the one from China to New York?
You cut out there for the latter part.
I'm curious about what it was like adjusting to that move to Canada.
So I think you would think that it would be like a switch. Like, I was legal now, I could be normal. But it was not. There was so much of my 5 years in New York that lived within me. I remember each time I had a full meal, I would feel like I had to throw up because my stomach was just not used to being full. And I finally went to the dentist for the first time in forever. And he said, "Do you just eat candy all the time because your teeth are in really bad shape?" And he lectured me, and then he wouldn't give me a lollipop on my way out. And I saw another kid with a lollipop on her way out, and I was very jealous. So I would say those 5 years lived within me until I started working on this book. And I definitely did not come to process any of it in during our time in Canada in high school and as a teen. And the conflicts between my parents, the conflicts between me and my parents were still there. Because once you have those arguments and bad words are shared, they live in the baggage of the family. And I would say it took us decades, really decades, to unearth all of that and heal from it.
You were working as a law clerk, and the judge, who I guess in some ways was like a mentor to you, said something that helped you sort of recognize what a huge role all these secrets had played in your life.
Yes. So I was a law clerk right after graduating from Yale Law School, and I happened to work on a federal court that handled a lot of immigration appeals and deportations. This was during the Trump administration when a lot of deportations were happening. And I remember being on my probably 20th, 40th immigration case and just feeling so guilty and ashamed. And I thought, man, what if she knew that I had been formerly undocumented? Maybe she doesn't want me to work on these cases. Does this count as a conflict of interest? I don't know. I was still a new lawyer. So I went in and just kind of vomited it all out. I'm sure she did not expect any of that. I sat down and I just shared my life story. And I had never done that, much less to someone in a position of authority. And she paused for a long time to make sure I got everything out, which I wasn't used to people doing. Like, I was not used to taking up space, especially with that story. And she said so many reassuring things about how, no, this is not going to be a problem. But most of all, she said, secrets, they hold so much power over us, don't they? And I was just like, how does she know? She's never been undocumented. How could she possibly know? And that was the sentence that kind of germinated this idea in my brain and started to grow that, no, we all have secrets. We all have shame. It's not just being undocumented. All of us have something, probably particularly from childhood, that we are deeply ashamed of, and we were conditioned to be deeply ashamed of, that we don't need to be. And that's what she was trying to tell me. And of course, you know, a conversation cannot undo 30 some years of conditioning, or back then 20 some years of conditioning. But it was, you know, a year or two after that conversation that I thought, I really have to work on this book. I see what she means now. She was a true mentor to me. And this book would not exist without her.
Did writing this free you from those secrets, or at least create a context for them that means they don't control you?
Absolutely. If you had asked me the night before pub, I would have had a different answer. I was freaking out. But having the book come out yesterday, I feel like a mountain has been lifted off my shoulders. And most of all, though, writing this book has been transformative because it really allowed me to see things from my parents' perspective. I mean, I, like so many teens and young adults, spent a lot of time hating my parents and especially my father. But writing it, looking back on it from childhood eyes, but then also seeing how he experienced it as a 30-some-year-old, how much I cried for him and my heart ached for him, it's forever changed our relationship for the better. And I feel, I mean, I don't know if we can ever fully heal from things like that, but I do feel like I am healing.
Chi-Anne Julie Wong is managing partner of the civil rights and education law firm Gottlieb and Wong LLP and author of the memoir Beautiful Country. Chi-Anne Julie, thank you for making this time to talk with us.
Thank you so much for having me.